Welcome to the Get Over Yourself podcast. This is author and athlete Brad Kearns discovering ways to be healthy, fit, and happy in hectic, high-stress modern life. So let's slow down and take a deep breath, take a cold plunge, and expertly balance that competitive intensity with an appreciation of the journey. That's the theme of the show. Here we go.
I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I'm just going back to, when did it start? It started when I was shoveling snow as a 12-year-old on school days, on snow days in Maine.
Instead of going to school? Or
yeah, well, a snow day, you stay home.
Oh, snow days, right.
You stay home.
And sorry, I wasn't familiar with a snow day.
No, snow day, you stay home because there's so much snow that
right.
People can't.
What are you going to do?
Get out, and so you go get your shovel and you make $80. You know, as
80 bucks as a 12-year-old?
As a 12-year-old
in the 60s?
Oh, that was, no, that was a week's pay. That was more than a week's pay for most people in my town. So, speaking of climbers, Alex Honnold.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He's got risk tolerance.
Like, he puts his skills on the line every time he climbs.
Yeah.
Because one mistake, and he's dead.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I don't have that kind of risk tolerance. But if you scale it back, I know my limitations. I know the likelihood of success, and I also know pretty much what's going to happen if I fail. We think about a lot about what we did yesterday or what we did a week ago and wish we could take it back or do it again or have a do-over. We think a lot about the future, like what if this happens or what if that doesn't happen, and we spend a lot of time in those moments that are not the present time, and the present really is all there is.
This is Brad. I want to tell you about my life-changing acquisition of a personal home-use sauna. I have a 6x6 barrel sauna in my backyard, ready-made heat therapy, a fabulous unit from almost heaven. Check out their website. You can very affordably order your own sauna for installation in your backyard or garage and have a sauna experience, the fabulous health benefits accruing from exposure to hot temperatures. Get that sweat going. These are beautiful traditional dry barrel saunas where you splash the water on the rocks, go in there and relax. It's become a social centerpiece at my home. People traveling from far and wide to come check out the barrel sauna, turn the dial or set the timer and walk in to 200 degrees in the Caribbean seas. For some reason, people like to come to the sauna more than my cold tub. Go figure. Check out almostheaven.com and their beautiful natural wood designs, and pretty soon, surprisingly affordable, you will be in the home sauna business. Let's give you some Mark Sisson, the legend of the primal paleo ancestral health movement. He's been talking for 12 years now about how to get your diet right, your exercise, your lifestyle, your sleep. But he's got so much more to say and so many interesting insights on other topics, especially the peak performance mindset, the entrepreneurial journey, which is so popular to reflect upon these days. And it was just really fun to kind of relax, hang out in his home and turn the mic on and get him talking about things that are kind of off the boilerplate, off the template. So I think you're really going to enjoy the show, coming on the heels of the ultimate Mark Sisson interview, one of the greatest episodes of all time on the Get Over Yourself podcast. So go back and search for that. It was one of the early shows. But here he focuses on one of his favorite words, his favorite concepts of pivoting, especially as it relates to your career pursuits, things that you put your heart and soul into and you're so committed to. But sometimes you got to wake up and reassess and realize that it's time to change course. And we also get into numerous other topics featured in the book Keto for Life and the third pillar of longevity, which we call mental flexibility. So we talk about pivoting, and then we transition into topics like the dangers of rumination and FOMO and how to avoid it, how to live in a state of gratitude and access that wonderful tool of gratitude when you need it most, when you're struggling, the importance of social connection and the disastrous effects of hyperconnectivity, overstimulation these days, reminiscing about the days when we didn't have the portable device, but how to correct things and just be the best you can be, prioritize relationships, and pursue Mark's wonderful stated goal of living awesome. So here we go with my main man, my mentor, Mark Sisson. Enjoy. Listen to the Sisson. We're back in the hot seat. Thank you for joining us on your own Primal Blueprint podcast.
That's a little weird, isn't it? Yeah. No, here we are in my dining room, and which we used to call the podcast studios in beautiful downtown Malibu, and now they're in downtown Pacific Palisades.
Wherever it takes, we chase you down, man.
Exactly.
Anywhere around.
Yep.
So we did a great show on the new book, Keto for Life, with the four pillars of longevity. And I thought this would be fun to focus on that pillar number three, mental flexibility, and the various attributes in there, because it is representing sort of a extension of what you've talked about for 12 years and hammered home so hard that you shouldn't eat grains and sugars. We've already heard plenty of that, but these new insights and how they tie into living awesome and promoting longevity are extremely important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the diet and the exercise are the easy parts, because the information is pretty finite, accessible, and with a little bit of discipline, you can make them happen. I think that the more difficult part of this would be the developing the mental flexibility, because while it sounds like it might be easy in concept, you know, our brains are pretty wired to chatter all the time, and to worry and to fret and to feel guilty and to take things personally, and all the things that we at least intuitively, we should not be doing, but we tend to do anyway. So the mental part is worthy of discussion and going into a deep dive today. So let's do that.
Well, I have my top secret little Sisson notepad of life-changing insights that I've gathered over the years with great privilege. Here and there, you drop a bomb, and I have to go think about it for days on end. And one of them, one of the concepts that you've represented so well is this ability to pivot and this mindset of being able to go with the flow. And I think particularly because your entrepreneurial journey is so representative of that, I'd like to focus on this concept of pivoting and what the word means to you.
Sure. Well, I mean, at its basis, it just means the ability to see a situation that's not working for you, and to be able to, with ease and grace, move in a different direction. But you know, there are lots of nuances to this. In the personal development, personal coaching world, they talk about the difference between having a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. You know, in a fixed mindset, you might say, well, I know what I want to do. I'm passionate about it. I have my plans. I have my goals set, and I'm going to go down this path, and nothing's going to keep me from doing it. And you see a lot of this on the internet today. You just, as long as you work hard and as long as you grind it out and put in 18-hour days, you know, you will be successful. And I take somewhat, exception to that comment, because shit happens. Things happen along the way. So if you have this fixed mindset and you're really all in with your plan and your program and your goal, that's great. But when things happen, I think it's important that you have the willingness and the ability to be flexible and to understand that, maybe where you're headed is not, something that you want to beat your head against. Maybe you have truly come up against something that's insurmountable and you need to walk around it or pivot or make a new plan. And so the idea of pivoting, for myself, I mean, look, my life has been just about nothing but pivots.
One pivot after another.
Yeah.
He doesn't play basketball.
But it's, you know, in retrospect, they all make perfect sense. Like one thing led to another, right? One door closes and two doors open is what they say. So I've always been geared toward having a goal in mind, whether it's a business goal, where I try one business and it isn't exactly what I had in mind, and so I try another business, whether it's an athletic goal where I try one sport and it doesn't work out the way I intended, so I try another sport. I'll give you an example in that. I started out as a miler and two miler on track team in college, and I just didn't have the speed. And I found out that as the distance got longer and longer, I was more proficient against the rest of the crowd. So when I finally got to the marathon, and I realized I'm pretty good at this. I can make myself hurt for longer than most people around me. I can participate and get raised at a certain level that allows me to finish in the top 1% or 0.1% versus middle of the field in a mile or 2 mile. So that was one of my first pivots. I just evolved into a different arena there. I did that for 5 years. I finished fifth in the U.S. National Championships in the marathon in 1980. But I got injured. I got severely beat up by all the training. And my choice was to either retire from competition mm-hmm. entirely or pivot. Now, when you say, well, pivot, I mean, I could have found a new sport. I guess I could have gone and played golf, but not at the level that I was participating. So my pivot in athletics was, I started riding a bike and learned the rudiments of swimming and was able to start participating in triathlons with using the endurance capacity and using the cardiovascular system that I had built, but now applying it to a different set of variables in leg muscles on a bike and yes, a little bit of running too, but it was mostly the combination of the three. So that was a way of pivoting. So I was able to keep my focus of being an elite athlete and participating at a high level, but not being so rigidly adhering to the one goal of being a top marathoner. Because that just, there was a point at which I recognized it was not going to happen. I was too, you know, I had the sorts of injuries that would not allow me to run 120 miles a week. Mm-hmm. But those injuries would not keep me from riding 220 miles a week on my bike, you know, and running 30 or 40 miles off of that, which was enough to allow me to continue to participate at that level. You know, in business, I've just done nothing but pivot from one business to the next. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I'm just going back to when did it start? It started when I was shoveling snow as a 12-year-old on snow days in Maine.
Instead of going to school or?
Yeah, well, a snow day, you stay home.
Oh, snow days, right.
You stay home.
And sorry, I wasn't familiar with a snow day.
No, snow day, you stay home because there's so much snow that
right.
people can't.
What are you going to do?
Get
kid?
Out. And so you go get your shovel and you make 80 bucks. You know, as
80 bucks as a 12-year-old?
As a 12-year-old
in the 60s?
Oh, that was, no, that was a week's pay. That was more than a week's pay for most people in my town. So that was
blinged out when you're 12.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But, and then, you know, I started mowing lawns. And so I was, you know, I was again 12, 13, 14 in the summers mowing lawns 40 hours a week, you know, not just part-time in between, you know, playing outside with my friends, but no, full-on 40-hour week job. And then from there, I started painting houses. I just learned how to, I went spent a summer working for a contractor, learned how to paint and decided I could do it. I could make more money doing it myself. Yeah. And I did, and I put myself through school painting houses. After I graduated college, I had a painting contracting business, and I made a lot of money for a guy as a painting contractor, and it enabled me to travel around the world and participate in these athletic events. So the business enabled my hobby of trying to become an elite athlete. At some point, I realized I didn't want to be painting all the time, so I hooked up with a college buddy of mine, and we opened a frozen yogurt shop in Palo Alto in 1981. Cool Licks frozen yogurt, and it was an amazing success. We actually bought a barber shop. We went in, we couldn't find a lease, so we bought out Gerardo the barber for $17,000. Took over his lease, gutted the place, and then because of my background as a contractor, we built this beautiful frozen yogurt emporium. We were one of the first places to have, this is 1981. We had, an overhead projector shooting, music videos, which were big, discs in those days onto a screen, above the counter. Anyway, it did very, very well. And so we got excited about opening more of these things. And we found a location down in San Jose near Apple Computer, in Cupertino. And we leased that place, but it was a very big place, and It's going to cost a lot more money to build it out than we thought. And we thought, well, let's just not just doing yogurt. Let's just do, we'll do frozen yogurt, 8 flavors of frozen yogurt. We'll do a salad bar. We built a 50-foot long salad bar that was refrigerated from underneath. There was a place called Soup Plantation that had just opened up, and we were sort of emulating what they were doing. And then Mrs. Fields had just started baking homemade cookies. So we had soup, we had salad, we had frozen yogurt, we had homemade cookies. And we borrowed money at 17.75% because that was the best deal you could get in those days, and completely lost, you know, our minds. I mean, the first year we had to make a $10,000 a month profit just to pay our debt service down. And if you know anything about restaurants, they're not necessarily profitable in their first year, let alone their first couple of months. So that tanked. And from there I pivoted and went to, Los Angeles to get into sports casting and, couldn't find a sports casting job, but, my agent said, you know, why don't you just take some acting classes and some singing classes and some, dance classes. And then I did the Groundlings. I don't know if you're familiar with the Groundlings, you know, the improv classes. And at the end of a year, while I didn't have a gig as a sportscaster, I got a bunch of gigs as an actor. So I did some acting jobs. I did some commercials. I did, you know, had some minor roles. I was on Dynasty. If you remember that TV show, Dynasty.
Remember the guy in the background that was serving the champagne at the party?
That's exactly what
Mark Sisson.
That was exactly what it was. Anyway, so, I realized I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to be myself. I wanted to be a sportscaster. So, yeah. I sort of, gave up on that whole thing and shifted away. I was coaching, top athletes at the time.
Young, hard-headed triathletes.
Not quite yet at that time, but I was, as a matter of fact. I was coaching you at that time, and then I got offered a job to go run the Triathlon Federation, Colorado Springs, in 1988, 89. So I went out to Colorado Springs, ran the Triathlon Federation for a while. Of course, 2 weeks into that job, who calls me? ESPN. They want me to be a sportscaster for triathlon, for the Bud Light Triathlon series.
Yeah. You were able to do that.
And
though.
I did that. Yeah, I was able to do it.
That's good.
But I mean, it's just, and I'm rambling about my story, but you know, one thing led to another and pivoting and all these twists and turns and all these things that happen. And at the end of the day, you still wind up sort of following the original path, you know, whatever that looked. It just doesn't look, when you finally achieve it, it doesn't look like the vision you had from day one, but you can still consider yourself successful for having identified these opportunities to pivot and make a shift.
Yeah. I mean, they're seemingly unrelated. And I guess, one common thread I'm picking up is that you didn't give a F, you didn't get discouraged, and you just jumped to the next thing with incredible enthusiasm. And I guess maybe that was the way that you leveraged all these things, success or fail, with the salad bar. You had the success with the yogurt stop, and then you pushed out to the outer limit, as you've been known to do throughout your life. And I guess then we're able to pull back.
Yeah.
But I mean, is there a common thread that you identify that pushed you to the next and the next?
Well, the common thread is passion and purpose. It's basically waking up in the morning and, you know, it's like I tell people, if everyone followed their passion, we'd all own an ice cream shop, because when we're 12 years old, like
Tasty Licks or whatever,
I want to have an ice cream shop. But, our passion shifts as we learn more about life and as we get interested in things, as we find out what we're good at, and where our own secret sauce is. So a lot of people are very, very passionate about a job that they never envision themselves doing, but they're good at it and they're serving people and they are excited about getting up every morning and exploring what that new world looks for them. And I mean, I think that that's the key, is to be excited about, whatever the opportunities are for what you're doing right now at that time. So as for me, as I shifted from one position to the next, it was always because, I saw an opportunity that interested me. And some of the interest stemmed from my previous experience. Mm-hmm. So the frozen yogurt shop to the restaurant.
Athletics into the leadership role in athletics.
Correct. Athletics into writing books about athletics.
Yeah.
Writing books about athletics into writing books about health and fitness and athletics. So training elite athletes and training to become an endurance athlete was just a little bit this far away from average people who wanted to lose weight and improve performance in the gym. So that was an easy transition, an easy pivot. Coaching elite athletes to becoming interested in the anti-doping movement and getting drafted to write the anti-doping rules for the sport of triathlon. And having written those rules for triathlon, then becoming the anti-doping commissioner for the sport of triathlon worldwide for 12 years. So I oversaw all the drug tests. They all make sense in the context of athletics, interested in performance, interested in legal performance-enhancing substances, and the difference between the two. Writing the anti-doping
rule. It's a thin, fine line.
But still, I mean, then I started a supplement company.
Yeah.
I started a supplement company because I was so interested in enhancing performance legally that I realized they didn't exist, you know, the kind of supplements I wish I'd had as an athlete didn't exist, so I started making those. I started selling those to athletes. And then I realized pretty quickly athletes don't really care that much about supplements. And so I started, my same supplements resonated with little old ladies who were living on a welfare check, but were reading a lot about, you know, how I can, about longevity. And they were watching a TV show called Know the Cause that I was appearing on as a guest. And the next thing you know, my entire business pivoted once again away from selling these high performance athletes, very specific multivitamin, multimineral, you know, antioxidant compounds, to addressing a much broader market of people who were interested in anti-aging. And so my whole anti-aging bent started at that point. And then as I started thinking about that, I started, you know, I have a lot of research on anti-aging. Let me put that down on a blog. Mm-hmm. And that became Mark's Daily Apple. Of course, before the blog was the TV show. I thought I'll do a TV show on anti-aging called Responsible Health. Shot, you know, 52 half hour episodes of that health show, aired it on Travel Channel, 8:30 every morning, and lost $1.5 million before I pulled the plug on that one. So, I'm sorry to be rambling here, but all these things,
this is what it's all about.
They're all
pivoting.
They're all connected in ways that if you look back, you go, oh, that was a, you know, that pivot, not only made sense because you'd run up against, a barrier that was not going to be possible to overcome. But opened a door that was probably even more lucrative than the original decision or the original intent.
Right. So you said that word opportunity along with passion. And it sounds like you always had that in the background. I mean, you've had to support a family for the last 30 years or what have you. Yeah. And so if we're not just supposed to follow our passions, how do we manage, putting the opportunity into the equation and then thinking of the opportunities that way or the choices?
It was important to me that I maintained a relationship with my wife and my kids and that I fed my kids.
Well, shoot, I shouldn't laugh because it seems like there's a few examples out there that we know about where someone just pursues their passions. What was the ice climber's name? Alex Lowe. He just kept climbing these crazy climbs and then he died, right?
Yeah.
I hope I'm right about that.
Yeah.
But that was a tragic story because here's this guy on top of the world. He had a little wife and kid at home and they would stress every time he'd leave town.
No, I mean, and you hear the famous quote, he died what he loved doing. I mean, okay, but you know,
could you make that face again for our video watchers? I mean, that's exactly it. It's like WTF, you die what you love doing. You still died.
Yeah. So, I think it's also very important in this context of metabolic, of mental flexibility to maintain balance and to say, look, I'm going to be very passionate about my vocation. But I'm also going to have, a good relationship with my family. I'm going to spend time with my kids. I'm going to, I'm going to enjoy the other parts of my life while I'm building this business or while I'm pursuing this passion. It doesn't have to be people who are just building business. I mean, you can be working for somebody else in a creative or senior position. It's not your business, but it's still your passion and you still are doing what you are good at and what you can provide as a benefit or service to the company that you're working for. But again, in all of this, there are very few circumstances in which I would say it's worth sacrificing, you know, your family's well-being, welfare, and health just because you're pursuing some dream like that.
Well, you were talking about that, I think, off the recording last time we were visiting about this, this reasonable tolerance for risk. And how it's really difficult to hit it big because it doesn't make sense to, you know, mortgage your home to try to open a frozen yogurt shop.
Yeah. And when I did that, by the way, I didn't have a family. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have kids. And so my risk tolerance was much higher. I had literally nothing to lose. And this, I think this is a common thread that you'll see in people who started businesses that have been wildly successful over the years. In many cases, yeah. they didn't have anything to lose. They weren't married yet. They didn't have kids yet. They weren't going deeply into, the kind of debt that was going to ruin them. They, in many cases, they borrowed, you know, they used other people's money. They raised money from venture capitalists or private equity people. So there's a, you know, and every person has to figure out what their risk tolerance is. And I had, I still would say I have a fairly low risk tolerance.
You're kidding.
I had a low risk tolerance in those days. It's just that I had a certain, confidence that I could make something happen. And I also had a certain confidence that if it didn't happen, I wasn't going to be thrown off the deep end and put into serious harm. So when I lost, when I lost $1.5 million on the TV show, and I didn't have $1.5 million to lose. Well, clearly I did because I lost it and I didn't go into debt. But I mean, I recovered, I pivoted, I came back, yeah. I started Mark's Daily Apple. Yeah. And from that, that grew into a very viable platform that ultimately was probably more powerful than a TV show that I could have had.
You're saying you don't have a high risk tolerance?
I don't compared to other people.
Like who? I mean, it seems like I'm just trying to get to the bottom of this because, you know, my picture of you is like, you have an amazing ability to put yourself on the line and roll the dice, unlike almost 99.99%.
No, it's really interesting you say that because I understand where you're coming from. And I would say, look at Alex. Speaking of climbers, Alex Honnold.
Uh-huh, okay? He's got risk tolerance.
He's got risk tolerance, and yet, and he puts his skills on the line every time he climbs.
Yeah.
Because one mistake, and he's dead.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I don't have that kind of risk tolerance. But if you scale it back, I know my limitations. I know, the likelihood of success. And I also know, pretty much what's going to happen if I fail.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a lot of what happens with a lot of people in business is they dream about what'll happen if they succeed, but they don't look at, okay, if I don't succeed, what's my realistic situation? Have I borrowed all my parents' retirement money to start this, dream shoe repair kit or something business that I thought was going to make it big and then failed miserably. And now not only am I have no money, but I've taken other people down with me. So people do that. And
that's big. Yeah.
And that's not the kind of risk that I would take.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean,
I think
like the delusional sociopath that, begs all his friends for money.
Yeah.
And then spends it cavalierly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in business.
Yeah.
So I think there's an obligation to an entrepreneur to assess risk, to evaluate the business that they're about to embark on. Is it a good business? Like, even if it's wildly successful, will it be a good business? Starting something and saying, well, in the best possible, I'm going to have $1 million company. And that's the best it's always ever going to be because that's the sort of the market that I'm in, the marketplace.
Yeah. Here's our projections, Mark. Would you like to invest someday if everything goes well?
Yeah. I mean, Taco Stand is a great business, but a Taco Stand in one city, one Taco Stand, doing $1 million a year, and somebody say, well, that's a very successful business. But unless you franchise it or put more of them out, that single Taco Stand doesn't scale beyond that. So, getting into the weeds here a little bit, but I think the ability to measure risk, to understand whether or not you have a great business idea in the first place. And again, look at it in terms of where am I in my life right now? If I have a family and I have kids and I have, mouths to feed and a roof that I need to put over people's heads, what are the limits of my behavior that would become inappropriate if I risked everything and lost it?
Yeah, borrowing from your buddies who are on a budget or what have you,
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so your example of pivoting was jumping from rock to rock starting at age 12.
Yeah.
I wonder also if it applies to...
Oh, that's funny. We talked about that a long time ago.
What? The rock to rock race?
The rock to rock.
Oh, the symbolism.
No, it's... Did you just think of that? Or
I just came up, man. You're jumping from rock to rock.
As I was a kid growing up in Maine has no beaches. It is literally, quote, the rock-bound coast of Maine.
Yeah.
And all it is a collection of boulders from... You know, small pebbles
to
car-sized boulders, and quite often we would run along the coast, jumping rock to rock, and you literally pivot. You can never run the rock-bound coast of Maine in a straight line. You have to pivot. You have to always be thinking three steps ahead.
Uh huh.
Right, because your momentum from one jump to the next, you still have to know what the next jump is after that, in order to get. To get good at this.
You're digging that symbolism, huh?
I'm going to do something with that. Yeah.
It reminds me when we were in Starbucks. I was just recovering from this horrible bout of vertigo. It left me in bed for like 9 days straight. And then I was complaining about my debts. And you said, so you're upside down and you have vertigo. I'm like, yeah, what about it, Mark?
Yeah, but
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
What the hell? Yeah.
You're the one who said upside down.
Yeah, I said the words upside down. And then we continued the conversation. You go, so Brad, you're upside down. Yeah. And you just, okay. So there's symbolism there. Oh, so the other aspect or the other application of pivoting, let's say, could be that you're resolute that this Primal Kitchen mayonnaise thing is the way to go, but they ran out of avocado oil. And now you have to pivot, but stay focused on the end goal. How does that weave in as a different description than jumping from rock to rock?
It's not a different description. They're very similar. It's just you have to, you know, if you keep your eye downfield and you think I had a vision for the food company and it was based on avocado oil. And in the event that avocado oil was, you know, found to either not be so fabulous for you or, you know, we were exhausting the world's supplies of avocado oil, I would have had to come up with another solution.
Yeah.
Another choice, another raw material to use. Thank God we didn't. And, you know, we continue to be one of the largest suppliers of avocado oil in the world. But those are always the sorts of questions that you have to keep, you know, you have to be ready to address them, because the other thing is every entrepreneur out there knows, business is just a roller coaster. It's the most amazing highs when you make a big sale to a company or you come up with a new product and it succeeds and it works. And then the horrible low is where you run out of money or the product didn't work or you have a whole manufacturing run that doesn't turn out the way you want. I mean, you and I in publishing, you know, we've had a run of 10,000 books.
This is a fantastic book. I can't wait to get it to market.
Well, not only that, I mean, we've had the duds, but also just you print the book and you realize that somebody in the chain of custody of the artwork forgot to change the ISBN barcode on the last one before it went to print. And now you have to take them all back and unbox them and put a new barcode on. That's just the stuff you have to be, business. You have to be, you know, not just ready, willing, and able, but you have to like not even think twice about, you know, woe is me and how bad things are. And that kind of gets us to, the concept of pivoting from a longevity and the point of view of this ability to roll with the punches, and to maintain well-being, mental well-being, along with physical well-being. The idea that if you look at all the blue zones is a good example of a book that talks about longevity and looks at the different factors. Certainly there's the food factor and there's the exercise factor, but one of the main factors in people who live to be 100 years old is their ability to roll with the punches, their ability to adapt to huge life crises, the death of a spouse or a child, the loss of a job, catastrophic loss through fire, earthquake, car accident or whatever. The ability to recover from those and not, you know, to move on. And that's a form of pivoting that is essential. And it's an essential skill, for life that conveys some, amount of longevity on people or reduces the risk for early demise.
How do you feel you're doing on that, objective?
Well, I'd like to think, I'm doing better. But I still have, that's probably my weak link in all of my pillars is that part of metabolic flexibility of moving on, of not
diet solid, workouts, pull ups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, making a living, making money solid. But you know, just stopping the monkey chatter in my brain is the toughest one.
Yeah. I'd asked you off camera, if you thought maybe, you know, you've had this drive, which anyone can understand, a 12-year-old on a snow day shoveling snow instead of playing. Well, they didn't have video games, sorry. Or instead of staying home reading a book and making brownies with his mom.
Yeah,
so you've had this, you know, this insatiable competitive instinct,
yeah,
which has gotten you a long way in that sense. So does that go hand in hand? You say you're getting better, which is nice for the audience to hear. But I don't know about... You know, do you feel like you're capable now of turning that volume all the way down to 0.5 instead of 11?
I don't think so. I think right now, like I'm looking for the next thing. You know, so I sold Primal Kitchen a year and 2 months ago, or a year and a month ago.
Oh, I thought you were just paddleboarding every day.
I was going to go apply for a paddleboard teaching job in Bali.
but they rejected your resume, didn't have experience.
Overqualified, yeah. No, I mean, I'm looking for the next thing because I feel compelled to take this gift that I have, such as I perceive it to be, and I'm not even going to be specific about what it is. I happen to think that it's identifying information in the world that's useful to people and then packaging it in a way that appeals to people, but also identifying products that I think are better for people.
Disruptive?
Disruptive would be a great, you know, a great, adjective for that. But I and since I've been unburdened with running the day-to-day operation of Primal Kitchen, I'm sort of like, okay, you know, what is it about today that has me compelled to and passionate to go, you know, hit the ground running and get something accomplished and work toward the next goal and be willing to pivot from there. And it's been a real a challenge. It's not a challenge. I mean, If anything, I've had too many ideas. Now the challenge is like focusing on whatever idea it is that I'm going to really hone in on and develop.
So do you notice sort of a shift in your disposition now that, let's say, you don't have the economic pressure that you or the drive that you necessarily had before?
A little bit, but not much. Uh-huh. No, the pressure's always there. It's a weird thing about having... money. The pressure just sort of goes along in different ways.
Yeah.
Different.
I mean, that's your choice, but that might be a positive rather than.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know that it is, but it's definitely it's a choice. You know, I would say the better choice would be to not worry about it because I don't have to.
But, and then continue to put the hammer down and do all the stuff, but not worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, that's, let's pause here and take a breath because that is, I mean, that's sort of the secret to probably being the best you can be in all ways. And I tried to capture that thinking back to, you know, we were both athletes in our racing days and very caught up because you have to be, and your ego is going to be a little bit fragile when you're out there training with people who are going to kick your ass one day and the next day you're back in the pack. And it's pretty tough from that perspective. But if we could just, you know, pursue the goal and not get caught up and not have the ego involved and not have this unnecessary pressure that causes stress, maybe that could open up more doors. That's why I'm asking the question, like, now, Mark, you're going to be okay. You're going to be able to pay for your home mortgage. Oh, you don't have a mortgage, whatever, you know, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
So now you can have that relaxed mindset, and then the edge can be entirely toward...
Which it is. That's...
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's... I don't want to, you know, overplay that, but I've gotten to that point where, you know, that part of the security is handled. That part of the brain that wants to have a secure future and know that everything's going to be okay. On the other hand, I think our brains tend to, you know, want the chase, the hunt, the game, the challenge to overcome. I think it's the human condition is to overcome. So there's this little interplay between being accepting of whatever happens, and that's the pivoting. You know, while you're in the game chasing, and so I mean, a lot of, again, life coaches are, you know, Instagram gurus will say, you know, if you're not, you know, if you're not growing, you're dying, or if you're not learning, you're whatever.
If you're not watering the plant, it's dying.
Something like that. Okay. Something. But you know, there is an element of truth to the fact that I think it's important for everybody to always be sort of moving ahead, and not being stagnant and complacent with where they are.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that looks like. It's different for everybody. But for me, it's like I need to have something, some project that I'm working on, some plan that I'm working on, some business idea, some book that I'm writing, whatever it is, something that is taking me in a direction that allows me to continue to grow and to continue to serve. And the pivoting comes in that if I'm headed in that direction, and again, it looks like it's not going to work, I don't just go, okay, I'm done, I quit.
Uh-huh,
it's like, okay,
uh-huh.
now I've, okay, I see. Now this is more of interest to me, or this is maybe a better way to do it, or
yeah,
a better idea. And I think that's the growth mindset that we talk about,
yeah,
at the Primal Health Coach Institute,
yeah,
which we have, you know, a lot of primal health coaches who are coaching people in their achieving better health through diet and exercise and,
yeah,
mindset and sleep. The whole idea of a growth mindset is one of being, again, open to new information, not so rigidly tied down to a business plan that you stick with a plan or else, you know, or else everything is considered a failure. If we didn't do it according to the plan, it's a failure. No, in most cases, the plan is just a nice little starting point,
uh-huh,
to be open to ideas and to be able to pivot and to be able to make changes and to be able to wind up at some point in a position that you think is, that you feel satisfied, very satisfied with, but may look nothing at all like what you first had in mind.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a doctor, you know, until I was 14 years old. From the age of 6 to 14, I wanted to be a doctor. And that's what I was going to do. And I lost my way in college, and I decided it wasn't right for me. And here I am at the age of 66, and I probably had more effect on people's health as a writer and as a blogger than I ever would have had as a doctor. So the vision, you know, was of being a physician and helping people,
yeah,
in a white coat and a stethoscope,
yeah,
as a teenager. But the end result looks far different from that, and yet it's a manifestation of that from day one.
Yeah. Yeah, you're just on the other side of the coin, keeping,
yeah,
people away from their doctor.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So you strike me, I know you pretty well, I've seen you behind the scenes, that you're capable of this, this badass, kick-ass day, high competitive intensity, and then able to unplug and go off on vacation or have a nice evening out and have some sushi and not be, consumed,
with rice, by the way.
Yeah.
Sushi with rice.
Yeah. Oh, with rice. Mark Sisson eats rice. He has a pinch of sugar in his coffee in the morning, too.
Yeah.
Would you, comment on that? What do you think? Can you unplug pretty well when you need to?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always have been, or?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is part of this balance, because I would say that there are people I know who claim to work 80, 90, 100 hours a week and never unplug. And then, you know, go home and sleep a couple hours and go back and do it again, whether or not they have families. And I think that that's just unhealthy, all the way around. Now, look, if you're a young entrepreneur and you've got a business that's demanding your attention all the time and you don't have a family and you don't have a relationship, then go for it. Then, you know, burn the candle at both ends for a while, or burn the candle at one end all the way down, I should say.
Right. Yeah.
You know, all the way down. But that's not conducive to a long life. That's not conducive to a happy life. That's just conducive to potentially making a lot of money at some point. So, you know, there are times in my life when I've had to grind it out and,
yeah,
and work extra hard. But for the most part, I've always kept this idea that I don't ever want my kids to hate me because I didn't spend time with them, right? And to this day, they never let me forget the fact that I spent so much time with them, boogie boarding and snowboarding, you know, and going to their soccer games and coaching Little League and refereeing soccer and all the stuff that I did.
Yeah, it seems like you can, quote, have it all in that sense. Like, I'm going to argue that all that time with your kids and that time away from the grind probably helped with creative inspiration,
100%.
Your health, your energy, your focus when it was time to go to work.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on.
No, I think people today are guilty of, you know, putting in too much time on the clock and not getting enough done.
There's our pull quote for the episode.
No, I mean,
yeah, for real. Yeah.
People, you know, at Primal Kitchen, we have, I'm going to say we have 80 employees at Primal Kitchen right now, and 25 of them work at the office, and the rest are scattered around the country as virtual employees. They work out of their homes. Do I worry about them because they're not punching a clock at 8 o'clock in the morning and then punching out at 5? No. Really, all I expect is that they get their job done. They be creative with what they do. And so the way I would look at it is I would rather have an employee who gives me, 2 hours of focused, good, productive work every day than somebody punches in for 8 hours and hangs out by the water cooler and is raiding the cafeteria at the company and playing pool or foosball in the company, rec room, and not getting anything done, but claiming that they put the time in, right? So,
yeah.
And we live in a world where that sort of productivity is measurable. Like people would say, well, you know, how do you measure people's, like at the end of the year, how do you take an employee who's on that sort of a flex schedule, who has unlimited vacation time, and how do you evaluate them? Like we are very clear about what we want as a task list from them, and they are expected to meet or exceed it. And after that, I really don't care how they did it. In fact, I'd rather have somebody wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning from a deep sleep and go, oh, that's the answer to this problem, and start to get up and write it down, than wait till the morning and come in and say, oh, I had a great idea last night, but I forgot about it when I woke up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you kind of covered this with your discussion prior to it, but we're trying to work our way through the mental flexibility chapter. And this other thing that comes up is the dangers, the health consequences of rumination. So you said you're getting better at it, but that's, I think, what the term would be for this, running the scenarios through your head and being anxious about where you're headed and all that.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people, look, we think about a lot about what we did yesterday or what we did a week ago and wish we could take it back or do it again or have a do-over. We think a lot about the future, like what if this happens or what if that doesn't happen. And we spend a lot of time in those moments that are not the present time. And the present really is all there is. I've said this in the past, but the present is a singularity through which an infinite number of possible futures must pass to become a finite past. Think about it for a second. The future is an infinite number of possibilities that have to go through the present time to become the past. If we can recognize that so much of our enjoyment of life has to do with our enjoyment of the present moment and the people that we're with. Brad, you and I are hanging out again. This is great. You know, we're talking, we're chatting it up here, and we're actually creating some work product, and we're having a good conversation. So we're communicating and connecting, versus what we would call rumination. This getting caught up in thoughts, and my biggest issue in that regard has always been like waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and starting to think about business problems that I have. And I went through a bad business cycle about 2 years ago for a year where I was in a bad business deal. I had to get out of it. I knew it was going to cost me millions of dollars at the very least to get out of. It was making me sick to my stomach and I wasn't sleeping. And then my wife, she's, you know, who sort of specializes in this field, Carrie, goes, look, you just got to get through your head that there's nothing you're going to do at two, unless you're going to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and actually fix it and make it and make a decision to start doing stuff. There's nothing you can do at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. So you have to get into this space to let it go. And her methodology was to say, okay, just lay your head sideways on your pillow and just let those thoughts ooze out of your ear into the pillow. And I started sleeping better.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, some little devices like that.
You call this spiritual psychology is her field of interest.
Yeah. It's a little bit more, it's more general well-being as a result of how we think. So the recognition that our thoughts are at the root of our well-being. And so many of us, you know, are not well simply because of our thoughts, even though we're eating right or exercising or doing all the right things. You know, we're still not emotionally in a state of well-being because we're pissed off at our neighbor, our spouse, our kids, our boss. You know, we're worried about the future, the past, whatever. So that's sort of what she specializes in.
The Carey Sisson blackboard at the house with the daily or the weekly saying, your thoughts are the source of all your pain.
Yeah.
It's what you think about what happened to you, not what happened to you that causes the pain.
Yeah.
And it's nice and cheerful to read that.
Yeah.
But then to take that and execute it every single day in life is the challenge. But at least we can open up to the idea and acknowledge that it's true and that we have the power to do it. It's pretty awesome.
Well, I mean, therein lies the challenge, because I think everybody intellectually understands, oh yeah, that makes sense, and then to try and actually make that happen and to try and untether yourself from those thoughts is a whole different situation. Oh, but my thoughts are different. You know, my
problems are real,
my
Mark.
My problems are real, exactly.
Yeah.
So
you don't understand.
No, and you know, we can talk about people who are incapacitated, in pain, have no money, and are happy as could be because they've got this whole well-being thing figured out. And all that matters is, are they happy? At the end of the day, all that matters is, are you happy? Right? Is this, you know, this wet mass of fat in your head, you know, churning happy thoughts versus miserable thoughts?
So what has worked for you in terms of putting that into action? Besides the oozing of the, was it pus colored ooze or was it blood colored?
No, it's liquid. Just a clear liquid.
Oh, clear. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, what works, it's interesting because there's not a exercise that you can do or a process. The only thing that works is recognizing it and going, oh, I'm having these thoughts. You know, these thoughts are causing me a pain or a problem or discomfort. I could just like that change those thoughts. Now, maybe I'm going to come back to those thoughts, but just the recognition that that's what's going on is the light bulb. That's the aha moment. If you can get that and observe in real time that you're having those thoughts and go, oh, that's interesting. You know, I got really pissed off at something my wife said. And you know, that wasn't right or wrong or good or bad. That was just, you know, her reality. It wasn't, and I didn't share that reality. But for her, it was 100% real and a reality. And yet, you know, I took it personally. Whatever. Just the recognition is the starting point.
Our buddy Dr. Ron Sinha, author of the South Asian Health Solution, expert in rumination, because his high income patients in Silicon Valley suffer from it to the extent that he's identified metabolic values associated with their flawed thinking.
Yeah.
It's incredible. He says, if you catch yourself ruminating, you identify it, like you just said. And he said, if it keeps happening, you just get a bowl of popcorn and pretend like you're watching your own movie. You just sit back and let it run out, but have that distance from it.
You know, what's funny is the term rumination. One of the quotes that Carey put on the blackboard is from Rumi.
It's
from Rumi.
Rumi doesn't like rumination.
No, Rumi. And Ron Sinha is from the nation that Rumi comes from. So he's from Rumi Nation.
Rumi Nation.
Oh, well.
Anyway. Oh, love it. You're good with those word things. When Paul Saladino came in, you started the podcast going, so your name's Salad, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, fun times, kicking it off. So then we got to this concept of journaling. I know Carey's big time into that scene, and you've been dabbling in it increasingly, and I wonder what's worked for you along those lines, or do you have your own little process to connect with gratitude, which is, I guess, one of the main attributes of journaling?
Well, so in terms of journaling, my journaling is basically writing ideas down for books. So I don't, I write, I carry a spiral, or a composition notebook with me. but I don't.
It was found at LAX recently, I heard. Oh, no, no. Okay. Yeah. Your notebook.
Oh, I mean, because I lost one.
His face is going.
And they go back. They go back a ways. But that's the extent of the journaling I do. I should probably do more. And I've tried some over the years. I'm not disciplined about it that way. And what else?
Well, you're connecting to gratitude is one of the high recommendations
of
journaling.
I try to do that. You know. Literally on off moments. Like that's like my go-to if I'm feeling down or bad or stressed. That's my go-to. Because it's a technique I learned in the meditation world is one of the ways to get set into a meditation is to start by, you know, expressing gratitude, you know, like three things you're grateful for. And that kind of gets you into a state of, readiness to accept
lower stress hormones in the bloodstream, all that. Yeah. So you'll do that as needed as a go-to. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. That's my, I don't have a regular, time of day for it.
Yeah.
It felt when I was doing it for a while, it felt like, I was, having to do it and coming up with, you know, with things that didn't, I had to, cause I was forced to, it was homework, right?
Yeah.
When it wasn't
homework
and it was like, okay, I feel myself going down there. Okay. What am I grateful for? Right at this moment. You know, what do I, and that's kind of what
got to force it.
Yeah. Well, now it's like, instead of being forced, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm sitting here. It's a cup of coffee. It's gratitude time. You know, what's going to be versus when it's forced upon me, it's like, okay, what around me, what, you know, what immediately am I grateful for right now? Without having to make stuff up. So, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Grateful that my car got me to this spot right now.
Yeah.
You know, didn't run out of gas because I was wrong. Grateful, you know, my feet are healthy because they were hurting the other day and I don't feel them at all right now. So, you know,
you wrote a nice post. I like the direction where you said there's no rules and you can be grateful for your badass new car that you just bought and also for your arches not hurting. And it can cross over from the material world to the spiritual. You're grateful to be here breathing the air in South Beach and the sun's shining on your bronze skin. You know, it can go all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, journal if you wish, people. It's highly recommended. We put in there about the experts, but I also can embrace that idea that you don't want to force it and just, you know, when you're ready, might be 2021. Who knows? Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, like I say, I carry a book around with me, a composition book, and I like to write in mechanical pencil.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Seuss.
I guess.
He wrote all his books by hand on LegalPad.
Yeah.
And he would get on an airplane. He was from San Diego and he'd fly to New York City and hand the manuscript over, the one and only copy. Imagine if like someone he'd left it in the seat pocket in front of you or something. But that was his way. He didn't do machines.
Right.
Because for whatever reason. Yeah.
I just read all the places you'll go to JJ this morning.
Oh, cute. That's your grandson.
Granddaughter. Yeah.
How old is she?
5 months. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So her eyes are open.
I read it for my own edification.
Yeah. Oh no, it has an impact as the brain research shows. Yeah. She's getting those words in her head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Then we get on to kind of the final closing section of the chapter and the podcast today. Thank you for your time. But this is the importance of social connection and the disastrous consequences that we're seeing in the digital age of loneliness and isolation. The stats we put in there are pretty scary. We're both going, holy crap, is this true? And we had to dig deep and find out that 26% of Americans are now, classified as lonely.
Yeah.
This is very interesting because, you know, you and I can both relate to half of our lives or whatever that was lived without the digital world. And now we're in this new scene.
Oh, more than half of mine, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, when I was growing up, all I had was I had my friends and, you know, we hung out all the time and we played together and, you know, went on triple and quadruple dates together. And it was, you know, there were groups of six, seven, eight people that would do stuff all the time together. So we really had that tribe effect, that tribe concept. Many of of those people are still friends of mine now. You know, my roommate from prep school is, you know, still one of my closest friends, and we stay connected all these years. Meanwhile, people today seem to have, you know, they have 5,000 Facebook friends and, you know, 100,000 Instagram followers, and yet they don't really know any of them. And worse than that, most of their friends don't know them. They think they know them, but they don't. So I think this you know, human connection is wired. We need it. It's part of our psyche. It's part of our DNA. Our genes expect us to be in close contact and speaking directly to and eye gazing and touching and hugging and all the things that we recognize as sort of human behavior, at least historically, have gotten kind of subsumed and put to the side as we have this digital world of connection. And like, I want to cry. I go into a room and I see 8 teenagers or even millennials sitting around in a semicircle, all on their on their devices. You walk down the street and everybody is, you know, tuned to their phone. It's beyond ridiculous. It's sad. And I don't know, you know, if there's going to be some, you know, massive backlash against that at some point.
Legislation?
No, I don't see that happening. But it doesn't make me feel great about the future if we can't pull back and start to understand how important human connection is on a one-to-one basis.
And you personally, are you fighting this battle? Do you notice in your daily life the to have boundaries or reduction in attention span, like I referenced for myself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I have a dramatically reduced attention span.
What were we talking about?
I know. It started with my work. I mean, you know, I'll do some research for an article, and next thing you know, I am going down rabbit holes, talking about pivoting. I'm linking to this and linking to that and linking to this, and the next thing you know, I'm miles away from where I started. But God, it's interesting, you know.
You're referencing a really good positive aspect of technology, the exchange of information.
You start out looking at the origins of global warming, and you know, 4 links later, you're looking at what happened to the 40 celebrities from the 1970s. I mean, it's like bizarre how you know that chain of that. That link chain goes. So it does take discipline, and it does take some thinking about it and go, you know, I think, you know, we have to find time where we just completely disconnect from the devices, of all devices, the tools that you would, that we talk about in the book. I mean, you know, allow yourself an hour a day to actually be involved in email, and then nothing else, because nothing comes into your email that demand your attention sooner than 24 hours for the most part. Don't get so connected with your Instagram persona. It's not who you are. That's the thing that's kind of going around now. I think a lot of the people on Instagram are recognizing that. That's not who you are. And so, so now people have gone the other way, and they're taking really ugly, unposed shots of themselves and saying, this is the real me, not the Instagram.
I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. I'm going to have to step up.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Anyway. Yeah. No, I just, all of which is to say, we just need to spend more time with real people connecting, go to a pub and have a beer with a friend, have a gluten-free beer with a friend.
and then as a part of that conversation, we identify that the love relationship is number one. It's probably the number one make or break longevity aspect when you compare a really happy, successful one with a dysfunctional one.
Yeah, so exactly. Going back to the blue zone concept and longevity and centenarians, people in long-term relationships, long-term, healthy, happy, loving relationships live longer than people who don't have relationships or who are in not so loving, toxic type relationships. So it's not just like be with somebody. It's like be with somebody.
And now you've been at it for 30 years with Carrie, 30 plus.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's some of your reflections?
No, it's tough. It's oftentimes it's very easy for couples to say, you know what? that's enough. We're done. Let's go.
Especially today with the distractibility potential.
Yeah. So we've hung in there and we've worked through some things and we're great now. And, we respect each other's, boundaries and personalities. And, so we work well together.
Yeah. And you feel like, I think you guys have some, nice balance between independence and then connection. And it seems to be important. Dr. John Gray said that you have to kind of make yourself happy and then you can have a relationship to make you happier.
I think that's exactly the realization we came to, was that, it's up to each of us to make ourselves happy and then we can build on that with the two of us.
And what's next, Mark? Your next thing is top secret.
Yeah.
Well, you want to talk a little teaser about the next book? Because it's kind of exciting to us anyway, that we're kind of cutting through this nonsense and this the diet wars, especially with in the age of propaganda and documentary mind washing. What's the solution, man?
Well, eating less food. Eating less food. But how do you do it?
Because could you speak into the microphone? Eating less food, Mark says.
Yeah. No, that's what it is. It's eating less food. The challenge is how do you get to the point where you're okay eating less food and you're not hungry and you're energetic and you have all of the positive aspects of enjoying food, enjoying every meal, every bite you eat, and eating less of it. And so that's the book will deep dive into that.
Love
so,
it.
It's a little bit of fasting. It's what we would call intermittent eating versus intermittent fasting. But all strategies on how to make it work for you as a life strategy, not just as a short-term fix.
Intermittent eating, new vocabulary term.
Yeah.
Shifting the cultural mindset away from intermittent fasting. Huge difference there.
Yeah.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening, everybody, and watching on YouTube.
Thanks for having me on my show.
Dun, 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 dun. Thank you for listening to the show. We would love your feedback at getoveryourselfpodcast@gmail.com. And we would also love if you could leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a hassle. You have to go to desktop iTunes, click on the tab that says ratings and reviews, and then click to rate the show anywhere from 5 to 5 stars. And it really helps spread the word so more people can find the show and get over themselves, 'cause they need to. Thanks for doing it.